Hi, I'm David Crowe. Happy New Year. All the best for 2018. Thank you for tuning into episode 169 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Jim Steele, our guest today, has spent his career teaching environmental education and advocating for wise environmental stewardship as the director of San Francisco State University's Sierra Nevada Field Campus. Among other things, his research led to the successful reclamation of watersheds in the Sierra Nevada mountains. While investigating declines in some bird populations, he considered anthropogenic climate change, but realized that maximum temperatures had been declining in that area since the 1930s, and that natural climate cycles such as El Niño and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation were better explanations. He's the author of Landscapes and Cycles, An Environmentalist Journey to Climate Skepticism. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave.
So perhaps you can describe your environmental work in the Sierras, what university it's associated with, where it's cited, and what kinds of things you research there.
Yeah, I was the director for San Francisco State University's Sierra Nevada Field Campus, which is located about 40 miles north of Lake Tahoe. My job was many faceted. One was to develop an environmental education program that we offered through the summer. And I also did research. We were hired by the U.S. Forest Service to monitor bird life throughout different wet meadows within that region. So I engaged in a lot of mark and recapture studies where we could get a sense of where the population's declining or are increasing. And we had one site that declined, but it was due to...
You're talking about declines in birds?
In the number of populations, the abundance of the birds. And
right.
the most of the places did not show any decline except for one, and it was a local factor where a railroad track 100 years ago had disrupted the hydrology, and now it causes meadow to drain after an El Nino event. And we fixed that, you know, so part of my work also was promoting habitat restoration, and we brought that meadow back. So even during the 3 years of the drought of California, the meadow was wetter during the drought than because of the restoration than before the drought when there was no restoration. And the bird life had increased by almost 50%.
And you're saying there was metal drainage, so there were toxic metals draining into the meadow? Is that correct?
Yeah, well, what happens, in especially where you don't have any bedrock to control how deep a channel can go. If you disrupt a stream channel, it cuts deeply down, and as it does that, it drains the subsurface water. The water table falls.
Right.
And when that happens, the shrubs, like the willows, which are, you know, a critical component for most of the bird life, and both for breeding and migrating, they start to die. They can't withstand the dryness if the water table drops, and then you have sagebrush come in instead. So we're able to bring the water table back up. The willows that were dying came back to life and full-blown, and the birds along with it. And then we could also see, anecdotally, a number of other wildlife benefits. So, and people at first, when we saw this draining meadow and the birds going down and the willows drying up, he said, oh, this is climate change. And
mm-hmm.
I looked at that, but the local U.S. historical climate network for around the Lake Tahoe area showed that the temperatures in the Sierra Nevada, the maximum temperatures, were actually higher in the 30s and 40s. So that's what prompted me to look for other things and uncover that it was a watershed issue, a channelization of the stream. And we fixed that. I got into this whole debate about climate change because I saw so many people too quickly jump on a climate change bandwagon and say, you know, your loss of meadow is just what the climate experts predicted would happen.
There was a question I wanted to ask. Is it's very easy to predict things in hindsight. You know, there are fires in California this year. Ergo, they're caused by climate change. The question is, can a theory like climate change predict whether next year California will have fires, droughts, floods, extreme snow, no snow, How is that going to be predicted, say, in the 2018-2019 winter? How accurate will that prediction be?
I don't think any climate researcher will say they can predict weather from one year to the next. You know, but they will predict, you know, and what's sort of being pushed is more CO2 makes more warming. So in the long run, we're going to see a drying out of the habitat. We're going to see less sea ice. But they'll do that on a long-term basis. You know, and I think we contacted basically on some blogs that I wrote about the fires here in California.
Yeah, well, maybe I should introduce the reason we've kind of had an extended introduction to your work, but I read an article by you in a magazine called Range, which I presume is about managing ranges or what in other parts of the world are called grazing areas, and it was entitled Wildfires, and you were talking about some of the other factors that occur with fires in California, and some of the other changes that could be causing some of these fires, apart from anthropogenic global warming. There's one of them, which seemed to be a big one, was fire suppression. Maybe that seems counterintuitive. When did people start to get very successful at suppressing fires in California?
Well, you can look over the country. I'd say they started suppressing fires in the 1900s. And what all fire colleges now would say is, you know, the more we try to suppress fires, the worse the result's going to be, because you cause this buildup of fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you also natural fires create a mosaic of habitat where you're creating natural fire breaks. And there's
right.
small fires that don't burn it so intensely. And in California, we have a summer drought. It's a Mediterranean climate.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
all the moisture gets pushed up to Washington and British Columbia
right.
During the summer. Well, down here, we rarely see any kind of rain at all.
Mm-hmm. And that's normal?
And so just,
that's historically
that's
normal.
That's what you get, a Mediterranean climate. And it's sort of way these high-pressure systems set up over the ocean. So you get something that's very similar to California as the Mediterranean, and then you go to the southern hemisphere, you get the same kind of thing around Chile and then over to Africa. And it's just this high-pressure system blocks any kind of storms coming through, and you block the monsoons, where if you go to Arizona and Texas, you have a monsoon pattern that happens because you can pull that moisture up into the deeper continent from the Gulf of Mexico. But we can't, in California, we don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
And from my field station, I could watch the storms come up into Nevada that are monsoon storms and see, you know, these thunder showers happening over Reno, where I'm having completely blue skies swimming in a lake.
Right, you're on the west side of the Sierras, and Nevada's on the east
side.
Yeah,
and I'm fairly close to the crest of the Sierras. So it's slightly on the west, but it's when you go to the east side of the Sierra, that's where the monsoons can come up.
Right, and what people would experience then is intense thunderstorms. It's not raining
right.
all the time in Nevada, obviously, but when it rains, it really rains.
Yeah.
And that, again, is normal. Destructive thunderstorms, flash flooding, things like that would be normal in a desert-like climate like a lot of Nevada.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of the fire, there's a couple things. Well, people say we're going to see a drying out due to warming. Well, sometimes you get a warming due to drying out. And in California, there's no average precipitation from year to year. And a lot of this is controlled by El Nino and La Niñas, and then intermediates, just the way the changing in surface temperatures of the ocean with the Pacific Decadal Oscillation will drive these pressure systems and allow rain events to hit the coast. If you look for the last 700 years at blue oaks, and they look at the tree rings, and these blue oaks are very sensitive to precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
The tree rings can give a nice history of how precipitation happens. And based on those tree rings, you can expect the kind of dryness we had for the last California drought about three times every century.
Mm-hmm.
And you can expect heavy rains about three times every century. And so this And it, when we did our restoration work, one thing you do is you look at all the sediments, and you can tell when you have a heavy flooding or a very dry spell by looking away at the sediments and the gravel changes. Mm-hmm. And you see these very erratic conditions that happen back and forth. So nothing that we've experienced is out of the ordinary. We experience extreme droughts and extreme floods with an El Nino, but that's within the realm of natural variability that you would expect for this kind of Mediterranean climate.
Yeah, in your article, you have a graph of tree ring, what you call tree ring anomalies, going back to the 1300s. I presume that's because you have trees that are that old. You have trees that are that old, right?
And they can find them that old. Or sometimes you can find stumps of fossil trees, and I'd have to go back and say what percentage of trees they used in that study. But in most tree ring studies, they try to get a combination of living trees and dead trees to get as much of a database as they can.
Right, and then I think they can, if they can see a tree ring pattern, they can perhaps, from a dead tree, which you don't really know exactly how old it is, but if you can match it with a living tree, then you can go back further in time.
Right, that's what they try to do. They try to match them up, and if you see the similar patterns, you can say, okay, I can splice these together and create a longer history.
Right. Okay, and so these, I presume in a wet year, you will find a bigger ring, and in a dry year, you'll find a very narrow ring. That's how they do this.
And so often you get a sense when they're trying to look at El Nino years and the effects of these specific decadal oscillations, you can see these wet years and dry years, you see a lot more growth during the wet years, and then when you have a dry year, you often have bigger fires because you've got a bigger fuel load during that time. I know in the Rocky Mountains, they did a study where following these El Nino years, that when you have a La Nina and a negative Pacific decadal oscillation, almost 75% of all their big fires in Rocky Mountain National Park happen during that kind of a climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times people say, here's something due to climate change, but what they're careless in doing is distinguishing between natural climate change, which would be an El Nino, La Nina, versus what CO2 is added to the mix.
Right. And I mean, the signal from anthropogenic climate change is believed to be very small over a long period of time. It would be insignificant if it wasn't extrapolated out over a century or more. But the oscillations, especially in California, or where I live in Alberta, from year to year, are huge.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Alberta, I think in 2015, we had massive fires due to a very dry spring. And 2 years before that, we had massive floods due to a confluence of rain and snow melt and a heavy snow year, all, you know, happening within a short amount of time. So, you know, is the climate getting drier or wetter, or is it just that these rare events happen regularly? Not regularly in that you can predict them, but every few years.
Well, ocean oscillations happen on like 60-year periods. And so a lot of times people haven't lived through the ups and downs. So you see this extreme change and people get a little nervous. Well, you know, why is this? And I firmly believe that we're really doing a disservice to the public by not really emphasizing these natural variabilities. And instead, we're emphasizing CO2. So a lot of times we hijack a natural climate event and blame it on a CO2 event. And we really, most scientists would say since the 1950s is the only time that CO2 had reached significant concentrations to really have any kind of effect on warming and hence temperature trends and any kind of extreme weather events. So we really we've only kind of seen events on part of an oscillation, and often their models are tuned to the increasing warmth during some of these oscillations. And what they need to do is go back. If we were to trust those models, they should be able to simulate the climate and the weather events that we've had since 1900. And most of the times they fail to get, In the United States, the greatest warming events happened in the 30s, and
right.
along with the Dust Bowl and everything else. In the Arctic, you had something very similar, that you had a reduced sea ice that was almost similar to what it is today from based on the Danish sea ice records back in the 30s. But when they try to simulate those kind of climate events, they already know the answer, but they can't get their models to do it. And a lot of times, because the models are tuned to be so sensitive to CO2, that when they try to simulate a warm event in the 30s, their models actually make it colder.
I mean, does anybody have a plausible idea of why the 30s and 40s were warmer?
Well, I've tried to write about that. A lot of the reason you have climate change is because of the way ocean and atmospheric heat gets transported from the tropics towards the poles. And we have good fishery data from the North Atlantic, because they know the North Atlantic Oscillation, and they would see changes in fisheries. So in the 30s, Greenland suddenly had a Atlantic cod come up to Greenland and start a cod fishery. And Europeans in the United States call Atlantic cod and Arctic cod and polar cod. They switch the names so it could be confusing. But anyways, let's say this: it's the warmer, loving Atlantic cod moved into Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And it stayed that way for 20 or 30 years. And then that and other warm, loving fish, sometimes they call them Mediterranean fish, went back to the Atlantic and the Arctic change. And we had a cooling period. If you look at instrumental data at Greenland, you would see this oscillation, a rising temperature in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It was associated with this influx of intruding warm water, and then a cooling through the 70s as this warm water receded. There were some German oceanographers, and there was a study published around 2013 that showed that a lot of those changes in the fish and where they're found and to what extent they're from southern waters or Arctic waters was almost the same now as it was back in the 30s. And there's a number of different studies that you can see from this fishery data, as well as some of the instrumental data in Greenland, that shows this natural oscillation. And that's what I think will give us the ability to distinguish what's natural from CO2 would be in the next 20 years. How does sea ice change? If sea ice keeps melting?
Right.
Go ahead. You want to ask?
Yeah. I think, I mean, based on what you've said, I think I kind of know the answer to this. But let's say that those who believe that CO2 is the largest environmental crisis we're facing right now, let's say that CO2 could be controlled in the atmosphere. Would that stop the climate from changing, and would that stop floods and fires and droughts from happening?
Well, absolutely not. That's what I'm saying is a disservice to the public. It's almost this kind of fear that we think that all these crazy things are only due to CO2, and without understanding these natural oscillations, these natural extreme events. If the world record for the hottest temperature happened in Death Valley, and it happened in 1913, and it hasn't been broken since then. So when you look at it, you say, well, how come you had the most extreme temperature there? Well, in 1913, well, solar insulation was lower back then. You know, the solar output, it kind of increased the irradiance.
Right.
CO2 was insignificant. So there's these natural ways that you have these pressure systems set up, and you can allow more heat from the sun if you have less clouds and you have less precipitation and drying. You can have these extreme events that have nothing to do with the sun or with CO2.
Sometimes I think there are just coincidental events, like I was describing the floods we had in Calgary in 2013 in a large part of southern Alberta, which were devastating. It like I said, it was a combination of a high snowpack. If that hadn't been there, there wouldn't have been the material for the floods. A cold spring up to a sudden warm rain. And so when you added the rain with all the snow melting all at the same time, we got catastrophic floods that have not been experienced for probably a century. But if any one of those factors, like if the rain had come more slowly or if it hadn't been a high snow year, there never would have been those dramatic floods, and maybe it would have been next year that, you know, it would have happened. But at some point, it's like going to Las Vegas, you know, somebody's going to roll all the dice the right way at some time. We know what's going to happen.
Look, and I think when people look at floods, they often say, well, here's a 50-year flood, here's a 100-year flood, here's a 1,000-year flood. When I bought my home here south of San Francisco, the town of Pacifica that I live in had experienced a 1982 El Nino and flooding where people had all built in the floodplains. And
right.
And I could smell it in the basement since there's no way I'm going to buy a house in a floodplain. The floodplain is there for a reason, and you might think it's 20 years of nice weather here and go ahead and build, but eventually you're putting yourself in danger.
Right.
And the other thing is in habitat restoration with streams and just looking at this, what most hydrologists would have said 20, 30 years ago is the way we have moved water off the land, the way we've taken away floodplains that can store the water for a while, we've changed a natural occurrence of a 50-year flood to a 25-year flood. And it's just by your a lot of times they'll put cement in to kind of funnel the water off the land around us.
Right.
What they're doing is just moving all that water down to the next town or the next region.
Right, like I think of Hurricane Katrina, you know, they had these big cement walls to prevent the flood in New Orleans, but once the water gets above those walls, then you now have a much bigger catastrophe than you would have had otherwise.
And what they also did, in all of your extreme weather textbooks that I knew from 20 years ago, said New Orleans was just a disaster waiting, because when they altered the channels, they dried out a lot of the land, and a lot of that land had been above sea level, sunk below it. Houston, which just got hammered, you know, they had in the 30s tremendous floods like that also. And they paved over most of what this swampland was, denying it water. And in the last 50 years, a lot of places in Houston had sunk by 10 feet, far more than what sea level is. And usually what people do, instead of talking about Houston being ignorant about these natural flood oscillations and what you're doing in your floodplain, they blame it on climate change. And I think if I was a city official who made these blunders, it's an easy out to blame climate change instead of saying we really built in the wrong place. We didn't understand the hydrology. We didn't understand how we were actually increasing the rate of flooding. And there was a couple papers before Houston was flooded that people came out and said we've basically paved over a swamp that normally held the water and prevented flooding, and we're just ready for a disaster to happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of landscape modifications that happen that are understandable that increase these rare floods and increase the severity of them. Yeah, obviously, if you have coastal forests, people might think, I want to build a house there, so I'll cut down those trees. And it happens incrementally and gradually. And it's only when you have the big flood. I mean, I think most people don't realize that the flood is now worse because the coastal forest is not there to buffer the storm surge, to absorb water, all of those things that can happen to mitigate the floods.
Absolutely. But your vegetation helps create porosity in the soil so you can absorb.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than asphalt or cement where the water, if it lands on it, has to go somewhere. Whereas if water lands on soil, it doesn't have to go anywhere. It can go into the soil. It doesn't have to immediately leave. But that's flooding. Let's go back to fires. So,
get off topic.
Yeah, no, that's fine. These are all interesting topics. But, I mean, it seems to me, well, first of all, would you describe a lot of California as a fire-driven ecosystem?
Absolutely. I'm a good botanist, and if you look at most of the trees and the vegetation, they're fire-adapted in different ways.
I mean, pine trees, in my understanding, are pretty much all fire-adapted trees.
Yeah, we have here the Monterey pines along the coast that they keep their seeds in closed cones until a fire comes by, and then they open up so they're the first to received after they can take all the nutrients that have been left by the fire. They started in Sequoia National Forest, is what they were realizing is they fires had to come through, clear the vegetation so the sequoia seedlings could sprout. They could only sprout in an open habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And by suppressing fires, you were suppressing the ability of the sequoias to reseed for themselves. And so they were starting to fade, and they realized here's a national park we could lose because we've suppressed fires. So they had to start having prescribed burns to kind of open up the habitat.
Sequoias being the redwoods.
Well, the sequoias are there's the redwood that's here on the coast, and then you have a sequoia that's in the Sierras.
Okay, but that's also a giant tree?
Say again?
That's also a giant tree, the sequoia?
They're both giant trees, closely related. So in the redwoods, it's fairly similar. And you have a bark that is the resistant to fire. And then you have the chaparral that's known to burn. So we have seeds that will stay in the ground 20, 50 years waiting for a burn to come through. And the seeds will come out after a fire. Others have what we call a burl, where you have a bud that's deeply embedded in the bark, so it doesn't get burnt by the fire. But as soon as the fire goes by, it's triggered and it starts to grow again. Black oaks are that way. And the Native Americans used to do a lot of fire farming.
Mm-hmm,
where
mm-hmm.
they would set fires to bring back certain plants they call fire followers that had good seeds that they could use. And the black oaks, if in the Sierra, you'll see pure stands of black oak that you wouldn't see unless there's a fire. And that's Native Americans preferred the black oaks in this region, so they would set fire. And when the new growth comes back, it's a little more lush. It's a little more vigorous because it's got the nutrients that's been released by the fire, and so that brings in more wildlife. So it's just a win-win of having a natural fire cycle that everything's adapted to.
I remember learning about jungles, and I had always thought that jungles would have very rich soil because there's so much life in a jungle, but I was taught, I don't know if this is true, that there's actually very little in the soil, because as soon as anything lands on the ground, it becomes absorbed by something else. But in a dry climate, a tree can fall to the ground, and the decay of that tree is going to be very slow unless it burns. Am I right there? So,
well, you're right. And what they would notice sometimes when they would deforest trees in the tropics, I think they call it laterite. It was almost like cement because there's mm-hmm. very little soil. Where in our northern forests, where it's colder, where it decomposes a lot slower, and there's more of a, you have the mushrooms, the fungi help break it down, but it takes a little bit longer time, that you have this tremendous soil buildup.
Right.
So
So what would happen if, in an undisturbed ecosystem, that you're saying that the fires would be more frequent and they'd be smaller, that a fire would create a small opening, and then if there's another fire adjacent to that, it might not cross that opening. So you'd have fires on a much more regular basis, but less area and less intensity. So what happens now with these California fires in terms of the temperatures that they reach, the areas that they reach? Is this a new thing that we're seeing?
Well, fire ecologists have been talking about this for 50 years, and what you see is when you have too much of a fuel load, the fires burn much hotter. So a lot of times you can kill the seed bank.
It
normally would have survived frequent burns, but light burns. So you get that intensity that might allow more embers to spread. The wine country fires that happened north of San Francisco was carried mostly by grasses and chaparral.
Right.
And when they try to give red flag warnings, that here's a high fire danger, they base it on looking at lag time and fuels, and they break it down to 1 hour fuel lag, 10 hours, 100 hours, 1,000 hours. But your grass and your chaparral are 1 to 10 hour lag fuels.
What do you mean by that? I don't understand.
Well, that's good.
Okay, you can explain it.
If I have just grass that just died, and I have a dry wind come by, within 1 hour, because its diameter is so thin, this diffusion of water goes from a moist grass to the dry wind, And within an hour, that grass can be highly combustible and,
okay,
and a fire danger. You get a slightly larger diameter with the twigs and the chaparral, and it takes 10 hours for that to happen.
Okay.
So you have most of the fire danger that's happened in Southern California, happened in wine country in Northern California. You had these extremely dry winds that came off the high desert.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And actually it happens as temperatures get colder and it pushes it. But because it's so dry, it sucks the moisture right out of these plants, and within a day, you now have a high fire danger. So you're looking at a weather event, not a climate event.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what people did. They started saying, oh, well, this is climate change. Well, what they've not told people, they've not been very explicit about, here's these fire dangers, and you need to protect yourself against it. Because when you build your property out into fire-prone areas, and we're going to have a drought every summer. And so by the end of the summer, no matter what kind of climate change is, all that fuel is ready to burn. And then when you get a Santa Ana, or what they call the Diablo winds come down, you dry that out. And I don't know if you ever try to start a campfire, but if you don't allow enough air, you can't get stuff to burn. But when you have a lot of air blowing through, people just have billows for their forges or for their fireplace, that can really cause everything to ignite. And that's what's happened here with these high, dry winds coming off the desert. And it happens when you start to get cold air, build up a high pressure in the high desert, and that pushes it out towards the ocean.
So
the worst fire season is December for Southern California.
Really? Yes, I have tried to get oxygen to a fire. I've almost hyperventilated a few times trying to get a fire going when my fire-making skills have not been as good as they should be. I would think, I mean, both grass and chaparral are fire-adapted species, right? Like, grass likes fire because as long as there's regular fires, the grass keeps coming back. If you get succession, you get bushes and trees, then there's not much more grass left.
Absolutely. And grasses grow, they keep their growing point. Like where a tree will grow from the tips, grass will go from the bottom, so it's sort of protected from when a fire goes by, and that's allows them to survive these prairie fires.
Yeah, I mean, when we have a fire in Calgary, which is prairie, the next year everything's twice as green, right?
You've released all those nutrients.
Yes. Whereas if the fuel stays on the ground, like these trees and things like that stay dry on the ground, they're not adding their nutrients back to the ground, and they're also building up to a much more devastating fire. But with grass and chaparral, I would have not thought that there was that much fuel relative to, say, a forest burning. So how did that result in such devastating fires?
You can have this thatch build up just
mm-hmm.
enough. And what happened is there was a fire in the wine country about 50 years ago, and people built out into that fire-prone wind tunnel, so to speak. Is the way the winds come over into the valley, they get amplified going through that valley, and the embers that come from the chaparral, they get blown into a house. If you looked at the wine country fires, you see these houses all burned to the ground, but the trees around them were fine.
Mm.
And a lot of what happens is the embers that were blown with the wind, they get trapped up under the eaves.
Right.
And what you should do in a fire-prone area is put some kind of screening so that can't happen. Or you find ways for that not to let those embers get trapped in your attic. You look at the way your ventilation systems are working.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a wall of fire swept into some of these suburban places, but it was these embers that the wind carried. And then once the house starts to burn, just the radiation from the heat of the house burning ignites the house next to it. So you'd see a whole neighborhood. You really only needed one or two houses to go up from embers, and it would just make the whole neighborhood go up.
So
the trees on the outside, a lot of them weren't even touched because there wasn't enough heat to kind of build up and take them down the same way the houses were. So I'm sure there's going to be some heavy investigation saying that we did not have the right regulations to protect people, or we didn't give them enough warnings about how those houses should have built with these fires.
I mean, you're saying that's what you're to some extent you're saying in that obviously things could have been done differently, and hopefully people will be amenable to that. I think oftentimes people don't like zoning rules because it makes their house building more expensive. There may be places they can't build, but when there's a destructive activity, maybe people get a wake-up call.
And, you know, I think the insurance companies would say, listen, if you don't do this, we're going to up your insurance here. They should learn from that. And we go back to floods. Most of the private insurance companies in the 50s in the United States said, we're not covering floods anymore. People in the highlands were not going to buy flood insurance because they didn't need it. And people that were in the floodplains, they would have to build sometimes three or four floods would take them out. The United States decided to subsidize these people, subsidize flood insurance, actually encouraging people to build out on the floodplain, which was bad for the environment because it's wetlands is one of our biggest losses in terms of wildlife. And it was putting people in harm's way by saying, you know, we'll cover your costs.
Where do people like to build in California that are places where they're maybe unknowingly building in a very fire dangerous location, or area where fires are very likely to happen? Is it on the edge of hills?
Southern California, out in the chaparral, they've been building. In flatlands, people like to build. Here in San Francisco, the parks, the preserves that were not touched by buildup were mountainous areas. People don't like to build there. What they often did around here is they removed the hillside, took that land, and filled in a wetland. So it's something about the ease of building in a flatter area. People tend to cover up a wetland. They'd prefer to do that than whatever the expenses are of building in a mountainous area.
And I guess if you're rich, I mean, just having been to California a few times, I think I can observe that rich people like to have some land around them. And, you know, on near a forest, people want to build big houses with a lot of land around it. And those are important, powerful people. When their houses burn down, the politicians are going to hear about it.
Well, that's part of it. So, you know, I think they even if you're, I think everybody likes to have land around them. There's just something about being in the nature that makes you feel better. I think it makes you live longer. We'd like to have more land around us if we could.
Right. I agree. I mean, it's an understandable thing, but I think a lot of people in LA live on little suburban lots with a tiny patch of grass and don't have the luxury of, you know, having forest behind them.
I guess you could say the wealthier can afford higher insurance, so they can build out there. But, you know, that's been a big issue with fire ecologists is you have this wildland-suburban interface where people are increasingly building out into the wildlands that are prone to fires.
Mm-hmm.
So now you look at how do you deal with the fuel loads? How do you deal with the fuel ladders? So you want to kind of, if you got trees around, you want to cut the branches so it doesn't allow a ladder for the flame to climb up.
Right.
You want to make sure you have a fire break. I know some people around Lake Tahoe, they wanted to move up there, but they were afraid of fires. So they golf courses become a nice place to live. And so you see these developments with a golf course and a lot of houses so you can live on a golf course. And people that don't even golf like that because it creates a fire break.
Oh, I see. So, I mean, the fire can only attack you from the outside, the inner part, which is the golf course.
Right. So you got a fairway of short grass that's moist and well-watered, and the tree, the fires will seldom jump that. They can still do that. And, you know, a lot of times you can have a fire break just with a road, but if you have high winds, the fire can jump those.
It's not far enough, yes. I mean, should we even be worrying about, like people worry about, did humans cause this fire? Did lightning, was it a down power line? But I'm wondering if that's kind of irrelevant, because if it's not a cigarette that somebody starts the fire with, if you have enough fuel load and enough dryness, something is going to start the fire at some point.
Yeah, there's just a paper out by Balch just this year. And what they did is they compared the number of lightning fires and the length of a fire season caused by lightning fires compared to human-ignited fires.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is you had a lot more fires caused by humans, and that the length of the fire season was three times as long for human-started fires versus lightning-started fires.
Okay, so humans can start a fire at any time of the year when it's dry enough, but with lightning, it has to be the time of the year when you're actually having lightning.
That's right. And the other thing is, a human-started fire can start when moisture levels are a little higher. You don't have to have as much excessive dryness to start these fires. You know, and sometimes the fire will dry stuff out as it's going. And that's what bothered me a lot about the fires here. It's like Governor Brown said, and a couple of climate scientists trying to push global warming said, well, now because of global warming, we're having fires all the time.
And you're thinking it's because of people.
It's because of if you look at these studies, it's you have fires all the time because you've got more people starting more fires. The fire season has been extended three times as long as would be natural.
So you are saying that prevention of fires is important, but
Absolutely. If
you prevent all fires, then you will end up with fewer very large fires, very powerful fires, right? So there has to be
right.
some...
And so that's, you want, what you want to do is be very wise about how you're protecting your property, how you're starting ignitions, but you also need to allow natural fires to happen, or else you're going to build up fuel loads that when a fire does happen, it can be devastating, both for naturally fire-adapted plants by being too hot and too intense and killing their seeds, and by spreading more and causing more habitat destruction.
Right. So if a fire burns too hot, I would imagine, and all the seeds are killed and all the standing trees are killed, then you could end up with, if you have a wet year the next year, you could end up with massive erosion. You could end up with a lush hillside turning into basically a desert.
And you get mudslide problems.
Right.
Yeah, it often will sterilize the soil in a way that takes a longer time for it to come back from these real hot fires. Where a less intense fire, you know, everything springs back the next year right away.
Well, can we have prescribed burns in an area where there's a lot of people, or is it just too dangerous? And so you're kind of a catch-22.
They are starting to have more prescribed burns, and they've been doing this for a few decades now. But they tend to put them out right away when you're threatening human habitat.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to say is we can say out in the wildlands we can allow more fires to burn, but then you got to create your own fire breaks around human habitat, and you can't allow the fuel loads to build up there. And so whose responsibility is that? And you know, if it's at some places, I think the private communities will get together, and I know a few places around Nevada City in California, they go out and they start trimming some of the shrubs. And the manzanita stuff that could carry fires towards their communities.
So, right. So you basically have to replace fire by manual removal of the fuel from the forest, otherwise.
Absolutely. And some people will use, where it's more grass, you can use wise grazing, holistic grazing management you can do.
Right.
So there's things we can do. I mean, and partly why I try to write this book, Landscapes and Cycles, is saying you have to look at what landscapes are doing, what, you know, how you're changing the landscape, how these natural cycles are working, to understand how to be good environmental stewards. And if you blame it on CO2, you're missing all that. You know, I just saw all this hype by Governor Brown. Not once was he talking about how to be a good environmental steward, but he was hyping this global warming thing. And I just think that's... it's a horrible thing. We're really doing a disservice to the public.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the important point is that even if CO2 was controlled such that the amount in the atmosphere was no longer going up, there would still be climate cycles. There would still be unpredictable events due to too much rain, not enough rain, too much fuel load in the forest. There's lots of other things apart from the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere that can cause catastrophic events. And part of it is that we live there, right? Like if a forest in California burned and nobody was living there, people probably wouldn't pay that much attention to it.
No, that's absolutely right. And you know, again, it's these 1 hour and 10 hour fuel loads. You're not going to stop that. I mean, that's a weather event that's just going to happen in dry winds in the summer. No matter what you do with climate change, that's always going to be an issue. And I haven't seen articles talking about that. You have to look into the literature on fire ecology and fire management to see people talking about that. But in the public, they're just not educating people about the real issues.
And I mean, part of the reasons people love California is because it is a fire-driven ecosystem. I mean, large stands of pine trees, the chaparral, lots of things people are looking at was put there by fire.
It was put there, you know, and it's more that our climate here is you have a warm, dry summer, and then you have a mild, wet winter, but you can be outside more. I grew up north of Boston where, you know, you walk out in the, I used to have a morning paper route, and the snot would freeze in my nose as soon as I went out the door.
Yes.
Not having that out here, you can be outside more, you know. And I would try to take a walk in the winter in Massachusetts, and I had to come back within 15 minutes. I was just frozen to the bone.
Yes.
Here, I'm hiking 5 miles every day.
Right. I probably some people would think, okay, if we just could leave the environment alone, it would all stay the same. But what we're looking at is not a static environment. We're looking at a point in time. And that at some point, what you're looking at might burn down and start all over again. And that's not a bad thing. That's natural. That's the way it should be. But if our house is in the middle of where it burned down, then we think that's a terrible thing, obviously, understandably.
Well, that's right. And so that's where you have to say, well, if I want to live here, I have to understand what's happening here naturally. I should be aware of a floodplain. The town I'm in, Pacifica, people built right on the edge of the cliffs, and they built on soil that was unconsolidated. So when you have an El Nino year, the cliff would start to wash away, and some of the houses were falling into the ocean. Now, I saw that, but other people, they're just not aware of it. You kind of think everything is permanent.
Right. Well, In Calgary, we have a big river that goes through town, and there's a nice bend in the river, and there's a very steep cliff, and at the top of the cliff, there are houses. And I look at that and go, 100 years from now, those houses are gone, and they've tried stabilizing that cliff. But basically, if you're on the outer side of the bend of the river, it is going to erode that. There's not much you can do about it unless you use millions of tons of cement to stop it, and it never should have been. Somebody should have looked at that and said, we should have a 100-meter setback from the edge of that cliff, because it's going to start going. But of course, people wanted to have a house on the edge of the cliff with the best view.
Well, there was a few houses I looked at to buy, and where the stream came by, I could see it just aiming at someone's backyard. I said, there's no way I want this. You know, it's a beautiful place. I'm right on the stream. I forget the man's name. He was the engineer responsible for building the first bridge across the Missouri River. And they have a quote saying, I'm the first person to build a bridge on the Missouri, and then I spent the rest of my career trying to make sure the river went under it.
Yes. Well,
hydrologists understand this. They understand that it's always moving, but people try to make everything stay as if it should never change.
Yes.
And that's kind of the weird part of this climate change thing is, you know, a lot here in south of San Francisco, the sea level 18,000 years ago was like 25, 30 miles further west. And as the glaciers melted, sea level rose, and our cliffs are just coming into equilibrium with a sea level change that was started 25,000 years ago. But people tend to think, oh, any change happened now is something we're doing right now. They don't have a long perspective on how there's none of these things are in total equilibrium yet. They're always changing.
Right. I mean, you basically, you got to roll with the punches, right? Like the climate is always going to be changing. There are, in a place like California, there's always going to be fires and droughts and floods and other things that can have devastating consequences. And all we can do is mitigate the consequences. You can't eliminate fires. You can't eliminate floods. There's nothing that you could do to eliminate them totally. And if you try to eliminate them, sometimes you just end up making them less frequent, but worse and more devastating.
Right.
Okay, well, we're kind of at the end, towards the end of the time that we've allocated for this conversation, so I'd just like to give you a chance to get out anything else that might be on your mind concerning this, or maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your book.
Well, I just, you know, I try to look at changes in wildlife that were being blamed on climate change. One thing I guess the last couple of weeks is, there's these skinny polar bear pictures that get floated in the media.
Right.
And everybody says, oh, look at this, it's climate change. Well, you know, as if a bear doesn't get sick or die naturally, they take one picture and say, oh, look at this, this horrible thing is happening. When what science is actually showing, the research is there's not one polar bear population now that's listed as declining. The numbers of bears have been steadily increasing. And this would happen naturally because when you have less ice, you have more photosynthesis. You can feed more fish, which feed more seals, which feed more bears. But they try to push this as, you know, here's this one picture of a sick bear. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes, I think everybody has seen. You can be sure that everybody's seen the emaciated bear. It was a terrible picture. But the guy who put the picture up said, we have no way of knowing whether this is global warming. I'm paraphrasing, but basically we want to alert people to what it will be like if our predictions are correct. He didn't say that part.
You know, they give a thin veneer of objectivity, but it's a propaganda piece. It's not what the data all shows.
Yes.
The polar bears are fatter and better.
Well, I went to the World Wildlife Fund, I think it was, their website, and they had a page on polar bears, and they were slightly different with what you said. I think there was one, they said there was one population declining, but the others were all stable or increasing. But they said it will change in the future, which, you know, is hard to say. I hate predicting what tomorrow's weather is going to be like, or I don't trust the people who pretend they can predict tomorrow's weather, let alone what it's going to be like for the polar bears 50 or 100 years from now.
Well, if you look at a historical perspective, just within the last 12,000 years that we'll call the Holocene, there was much less ice in the Arctic. Most of the glaciers had shrunk, Greenland had shrunk. Some glaciers that are there now that formed during the Little Ice Age were not there 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. Tree line went all the way to the Arctic back about 9,000 years ago. The polar bears have existed through all of that. And so to say that they're all going to die and get skinny and starving using this picture is really distorting what the future is going to be. It's trying to put a catastrophic look on future predictions and ignoring what we know.
It was interesting. There's a Canadian author, an environmentalist, who's now deceased, Farley Mote, who wrote a lot about the North.
Oh, yeah. I've Never Cry Wolf.
Yes, things like that.
People of the Deer.
Right, he wrote a book about Canada's destruction of our environment, how we, like, fished everything and we killed every animal on land. And, you know, it was a horrible book because it just documented the slaughter of wildlife to the point where we had to actually put in laws to protect what little was left. One of the things he said was that the polar bears used to go very far south into the forest, that they weren't always seen as an Arctic bear, but I guess because they were big, dangerous, and visible, we basically exterminated them up to the Arctic where there weren't enough of us and there were a lot more of them. I don't know if that's true, because I don't think everything Farley Mote was said is reliable. But that would indicate that they were quite happy living in warmer climates.
Well, and I wrote this in the book, that in Wrangel Island, which is just north of the Bering Strait, it's one of the largest polar bear denning areas. And the people that studied that, they noticed when we had the 2007 extreme drop in sea ice, that the bears on Wrangel Island were fatter than they'd seen.
Mm.
And one of the researchers says, this gives me insight into how they would have survived, you know, during the Holocene when it was much warmer, there was much less ice. And part of it is you get the walrus come ashore. And they have places on Wrangel Island where the bears were just sitting there waiting for the annual arrival of the walrus.
Right.
And you know, you'll see them feeding on dead whales or whatever. The polar bears are just very adaptive, and each one has a slightly different way of feeding and expertise.
Well, but, I mean, that's true. I guess it's kind of arrogant for us as humans to think that polar bears are static. They're not just living in a dynamic ecosystem, but they're also highly intelligent beings with a large brain, and so they could probably easily adapt if all the seals disappeared and something else came in instead of them. I imagine they would adapt to eating that animal instead.
And there's a number of seals, like in Hudson Bay, there's a number of seals that come into the Hudson Bay, like harp seals and harbor seals, after the ice goes. And they do well in the Hudson Bay. And every year, all the ice goes away from the Hudson Bay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the Baffin Bay, it's the same kind of thing. The ice that's important is springtime ice. That's when during the winter, when there's lots of ice, all the polar bears are losing weight.
Right, they're denning, right?
And if you have these seals, the ring seals that live through the winter, trying to wait at their air holes, well, they have a number of different breathing holes. The success rate of getting a seal in the winter is very low. The high success rate of hunting is when they have to have their pups, and that happens around March, April, and May.
Which is probably no coincidence that they're having their pups at the time when they can actually get food.
And that's when the females come out of their dens. And what they've shown is the bears will triple and quadruple their weight just feeding on seal pups in the early spring.
Okay, we really are butting up against the hour.
Okay.
It's been lovely talking to you, and I think it's good for people to think about these things, because we all still live in a natural environment, and we need to adapt to that, and no matter what, it's going to keep changing.
Absolutely. Before we start blaming CO2, look at what landscapes of changes have happened, look at natural cycles. And then anything excessive that, then we can blame on CO2, but you got to understand these natural habitats.
Thank you so much
for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining me today. Thanks, Jim.
All right, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 169 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth, commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth, and I wish everybody a happy and productive 2018. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.